Hello and welcome to another episode of It Was Mooney, your source for all things movie, streaming, and pop culture related. I'm your host, Kosi, and I'm joined always by Wani B. And today we're joined in studio once again by a friend of the show. What's up, brother? Jim, how's it going,
Jimothy,
buddy?
Jimothy. Howdy do. Glad to be back.
Hells yeah, brother. Thanks for joining us once again, man.
Always happy to have you, brother.
Yeah, yeah. Brother. Yeah, man.
Good to hear you. Nice to see Maurice again.
Right? Dude, Maurice. It's Jim. See? Okay, all right, whatever. Maurice. Whatever, Maurice. Maurice is being cranky. That guy. Anyway, man, once again, guys, as always, this episode you're hearing is recorded before our live studio ostrich. But Wani B, what we got on tap for today's show?
Hey, how you doing, guys? Today, we go into another trailer trash.
All right.
We go over the trailers for... Actually, we're going to hit you guys with a curveball today.
What?
We're going to have a video game trailer trash day.
Oh my god, okay.
Basically, we're going to go over some of the trailers come out in the Xbox showcase this past week. We're going to talk about Dragon Age Veilguard, talk about the new Gears of War game, and finally talk about Doom Dark Age.
Yes, the Dark Ages.
Doom the Dark Ages.
Hell yeah.
So, to kick it off, again, we already mentioned, but welcome to the show, Jim. Happy to have you here as always.
Thank you. Glad to be here. It's a pleasure to be back.
Nice, dude.
All right.
No, third multi-time guest, I think, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Long-time listener, too, so always appreciate that. Good friend of the show, good friend in personal life, good guy, Jim.
Yeah, man, and also he chose a really great episode to come on to because, you know, our main topic for today that we're going
over.
We're
going to talk about Shogun.
Dude.
We're going to mostly discuss the new, not just the new TV show that everybody's heard about. We're going to discuss the original book, one of Jim's favorite books.
Absolutely.
We're going to discuss actually the miniseries. Was it 1980
miniseries? 1980 miniseries, yeah.
Based on also the same book, of course. And we'll give a hearty review of the recent recent show that came out on FX.
And also to listeners at home, I know y'all can't see this, but you hear that? That's the sound of notes. So Jim here brought receipts. So just know we're going to get into this
on Shogun. This is a four-page set of notes.
I love this
stapled.
Guy. I love this guy.
You know, it has bullet points. It has different fonts. We're talking about full all-out. This is why we love Jim. This
Please
is a guy
quiz. Here to discuss.
Studious,
here to discuss.
Organized.
He's going to quiz us at the
knows,
end of the show.
Knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to get some in-depth talk. If you remember the anime episode, we're going to hit you with some deep knowledge, with some guy who knows what he's talking about. That's what we love about Jim.
Yes, sir.
That's what I'm here for. But first, let's start off with that trailer trash.
Trailer trash, baby. So, today's trailer trash, again, as we let you know earlier, hitting you guys with a curveball. Usually, we're going to hit you guys with movies, maybe TV shows, big trailers of the day. Honestly, there wasn't too many big trailers this week, right,
Kelsey? Yeah, I was looking through, but nothing here, but you told me about the Xbox Showcase.
Xbox Showcase, I believe.
So what is that, real quick, in a nutshell?
Like. So, basically, some listeners might remember the E3 of old. It's basically an industry showcase, right? It's kind of a press conference. Not really a press conference. They show a bunch of trailers. They have an actual show, like a studio show, on a stage usually.
All right. A lot of presentations by companies about what's upcoming, what to expect.
Kind of like Comic-Con a little bit, but for like
Xbox. Yeah, Comic-Con for video
games. Comic-Con's a little bit different because Comic-Con is open kind of to the public. This is more for professionals, for video game journalists, for the media, for the industry.
Yes.
Okay. Right, and then it gets filtered out to us. It's not the kind of thing you can just casually attend. And
you might have to be a journalist.
It reminds a little bit of a CinemaCon too, a little bit, but they do for like the movie vendors. So yeah, kind of reminds you. Of that
right, right. No, it's definitely a way for them to filter out their message to a larger audience. And difference between E3 is that Xbox or Microsoft gets to control, you know, the whole presentation. Right, it's their presentation. They get to show their games. Even if some of them might be coming out on other consoles, but it gets to be a focus on what they do best and kind of obviously a commercial for Xbox itself.
Cool.
But in this case, we're going to focus mostly on the games coming out tonight.
Right. Their exclusives and why you should buy an Xbox.
Right.
Or that's, play their.
That's
PC.
Kind of the point.
I was seeing
to be
that.
Funny,
was
most of these games that are coming out are actually not exclusive to Xbox. Obviously, you can get most of them on PC, and I think at least two of them are going to be out on PlayStation and have historically been on most consoles other than Nintendo consoles.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. So to start off, we're going to start off with Dragon Age Veilguard. There's been two trailers that came out. We watched the story, the introduction trailer. Jim, what are your thoughts?
I like how they were introducing each of the different classes to give you kind of anticipation.
I'm sorry, Jim. Before you go in, I know nothing of Dragon Age, so like for a person that doesn't know about Dragon Age, can you just break that down for us at home?
I'll give kind of an overview then of the trailer and then the Dragon Age series in general. So the Dragon Age series is a series of fantasy games. Think kind of a Lord of the Rings type world.
Okay.
Right, you got, you know, wizards, you got dragons, obviously, you got undead type people, you got elves, dwarves. It's very Lord of the Ring-esque, right?
All your traditional fantasy tropes, your fantasy aspects, the classes there, such as barbarians, wizards, archers, they're all listed there, and they kind of play their own way, and you can create your own character and build your own story there.
Right, the main character. Okay. So it's a BioWare game. BioWare games became famous. You might have heard of Mass Effect, Dragon Age, Jade Empire back in the day. Might be a deep cut for some of y'all. KOTOR, Knights of the Old Republic. So their main calling card, basically, was that they created these heavy narrative, choice-based RPGs, where you create a main character, you get cast into a central role in the story, and you know you have different choices. You can do some good things, some villainous things. You can ally with different people. You can romance those allies or become their enemies.
It's kind of similar to like Warcraft in any way, like the gameplay or the...
So maybe the world building is a little similar. Maybe it's not too... It's more of a D&D... knockoff.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing here. I'm like, just looking at the description of it.
It's more of a Dungeons and Dragons. Even the first game had a lot of similarities to Baldur's Gate and other Dungeons and Dragons games. It was kind of based on that type of game originally. It does have a lot of unique aspects to its world building. For instance, the wizards are all considered... Wizards can get possessed by demons and by spirits more easily than other types of humans. And then when the wizards do get possessed, they can destroy and cause mass death and carnage. So wizards are treated as kind of almost like a slave class. They're kept in towers, they're chained up, they're hunted down. They're, you know, very much kept as a captive class. I don't know if you ever watched Attack on Titan, the way the Eldians are kept is kind of the way the wizards are kept. And then the Templars, the church, are the people that control the wizards and kind of try to keep the order. Elves are actually, instead of the usual immortal, regal, kind of superior race, they're actually basically hobos. They live in slums, they die easily. It has its own different aspects. So anyways, this trailer mostly is showing the different characters and the different classes that are going to show up, right? The main dwarf they showed at the beginning, his name is Varric. He's been in a couple of the other games.
Yeah, I've seen that guy like on
He's kind of almost the narrator, kind of like
the mascot of the whole series.
Yeah, kind of the mascot. He shows up in the trailers. Mm-hmm. He's a funny-go-lucky kind of guy you like to hang out and grab a beer with type of guy.
Right, tells a good story.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, if you remember Tyrion Lannister, he's kind of a good comparison.
No, thanks for the breakdown of that one. But as a person that doesn't play this at all, just the gameplay and the footage that I saw, I definitely would want to play this game. It did its job as a trailer for a game. I didn't realize it was such an extensive like world around it. It's been around.
So there's been three games already.
This is the fourth
game.
Yes.
Wow.
The third one ended on a huge cliffhanger where basically one of the gods of the lore, kind of like you're kind of the gods from way back in the past that you almost suspect aren't even real, that they don't give you, like, you know, like kind of myths, right? Basically, if the equivalent of Poseidon suddenly came out of nowhere, or the equivalent of Hades suddenly came and it turned out to be a real person, right? That's kind of what happened at the end of the previous game, right? Mm-hmm. And he's kind of trying to reset the world. So it's very interesting. Should be a fun game. We'll see how they do.
Looks awesome. Looks awesome. Yeah, it comes out this year.
Yeah, it's supposed to come out fall 2024.
I'm surprised by how soon it's going to come out, and it's going to transition from what everybody's been playing Baldur's Gate 3 as their fantasy flavor, and now with Dragon Age as the new oncoming one, I think we'll move into that as our fantasy flavor.
You see this gym as like the new game to play in that
genre? In theory, it has the name. We'll see, because BioWare has been messing up lately. A lot of the original names that made some of these games have left the company. So they have a lot to prove as far as if they can really make this game be as good as the previous ones.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. But anyways, moving on. So we're going to talk about Gears of War.
Oh, yeah.
E-Day.
It was Gears of War E-Day. So right off the bat from the trailer, it seems we're going back to the original duo. Is that correct?
Definitely
that
saw Marcus
looks like
in there.
A bit of a nostalgia factor.
Well, what was their names?
Marcus Phoenix.
Yes, Marcus Phoenix. And what was the other guy?
Dominic? No. I don't
remember. Because you remember?
I remember
Marcus.
Three.
Yeah, I remember Marcus.
And he's the one with the do-rag.
But yeah, but it does have a nostalgia vibe where you have the original two protagonists. I actually didn't play too many of the Gears games. I played some of the horde modes, It was always famous for having that chainsaw gun.
Yes, very satisfying.
You could rip apart enemies with the chainsaw attached to the gun you were shooting them with. It was a cool little combo move.
It had really, what I call like iconic type weapons and gameplay. But looking at this, so this story, E-Day, tells a story of Emergence Day on Sarah. So that was Marcus and Dom. So they're fighting off the heretofore, the unknown locusts that are trying to attack her. So it's
Like a prequel?
Yeah, it's almost like a Quiet Place Day 1 kind of sort of thing.
Where we're going back to the beginning. Story.
That's why we're going back.
Okay. Yeah, that's where he got his do-rag. Like we saw him get the iconic do-rag in this short. It was pretty cool.
That doesn't make sense because they almost did look young.
Yeah, they look a lot younger.
They did.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not the same actors as video games, so.
Right.
It's crazy what has been almost. The original games came out, 2009?
Oh,
I think 2009.
Earlier than 20. Okay.
Yeah.
Around the beginning of the Xbox 360 generation. Mm-hmm. Right? It's been one of the Microsoft staples. Yeah, Halo's kind of fallen off, so this is. Gears might be the premier.
Yeah, well, the first. Yeah,
it's a different genre with third person shooting.
Yeah, but that might be the premier Xbox game at series at this point.
Between Halo and Gears,
Halo's been kind of falling off.
I'm not even sure what the most recent Halo game is.
Halo Legends, I think it was, that open world game. Yeah. I didn't hear great things.
The last one I actually remember was Reach. Was that 2010?
Reach was still when Bungie was around. Yeah. That was.
Yeah, I remember that one.
I've heard from most. I played a little bit of that one. I've heard from most Halo fans say that was one of the last good ones.
Yes, the last one I played was the RTS. That was a weird one.
Oh, that was that's the real time strategy game.
The only thing though, that was a really awesome trailer, but there's clearly no release date though. So it's like I guess is it custom for them to put out a trailer?
It's kind of a teaser trailer, kind of.
But is that custom?
An announcement that they're making the game. Okay. It happens a lot in the video game industry
because you don't see it in movies. Like if the trailer's out, that's because the movie's coming
out. So here's the thing with a movie: the trailer's usually scenes from the movie. You have to be pretty far along, finished to be able to film a trailer, right?
Gotcha.
And obviously the time frame for video games. Obviously, some movies take forever, right? We've seen James Cameron take 10 years per movie. Mm. But the turnaround time for a standard movie is a lot shorter than it is for AAA, these massive video games. The amount of time it takes to get the animation done.
And to be clear, this trailer used the in-game engine. It wasn't a special CGI, just...
So explain that. Trailer. So that wasn't gameplay. That was just the engine in the game.
So old-time video game players might remember Final Fantasy VII or old games where the cutscenes looked amazing, looked like TV graphics, looked like Toy Story. Then the actual game looked like a bunch of polygonal crappy
blocky
mess. Yeah,
we got polygons.
Yeah, a lot of polygons. Triangle titties and stuff.
Oh yeah.
Lara Croft, right? Anyways, so usually the cutscene was basically done with a different engine that could since you could render anything, you didn't have to actually have the person control it. You could make it very fancy and do cool things with it. Nowadays, video game engines have gotten so advanced, the in-game engines that you're actually playing have gotten so advanced that it, for the most part, just straight up looks better if you just use the in-game engine rather than using like a stylized kind of cutscene engine, right? It's kind of a waste of time for them at this point. The actual in-game engine looks so good, they might as well use that to record something nice. And it tells people that this is what the game actually looks like versus putting out some cool, you know, cutscene trailer that takes a lot of time and effort to put out.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? As a consumer, like, just watching that, I actually like that because you're showing me, like, you know, the stuff from in within the game. Like, it does a lot as, like, it's a 1-2 punch of a kind of, like, a marketing ploy. It's like, here's what to expect in the game. But also, it's also a piece of just, like, art and, like, marketing in of itself. So
it would leave a bad taste. You can back me up on this, Jim. It would leave a bad taste when you'd watch, like, a Final Fantasy game and the cutscenes would look incredible and they'd use that in the trailer. And then you'd play the game and it's like, okay, this looks like...
Yeah, it's lacking a little bit.
It looks terrible compared to the cutscenes.
Wait, Jim, has that happened?
Of course. Before?
Like, where? What's
I mean, previous games are always going to be like that. PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2 games.
Yeah, we're talking about, like, old school games.
Yeah,
we're
so
about,
it's not going to be
even maybe
era.
PlayStation 3 games.
Yeah, even
so. It was probably the last generation it really happened a lot. By the time PlayStation 4, Xbox One rolled around, for the most part, companies, between learning and just the engines are so good, they just tend to show stuff in the real engine and then just use the art direction, use the lighting, use the models to, even when sometimes the actual graphical prowess isn't that high, it can still look really good because the artist did such a great job of rendering something that looks nice.
Speaking of stuff that looks nice, talking about our third and final trailer.
So final trailer, guys.
Oh, my God.
Doom the Dark Ages.
Man.
So oh, my God.
Easily the game that has us all the most hyped.
Yeah, I think I applauded. I think I applauded after the trailer.
Doom Guy, the Slayer.
So kind of an overview. Listen, a lot of y'all are probably familiar with him. For the ones that aren't, Doom Guy is basically...
when he goes to fight demons, demons are afraid of him. When you go into hell, the demons that in hell are running away from you scared, trying to kill you because they are boggled that you are there trying to
essentially slay to him. He's like the superhero, hell yeah. Superhuman. He almost presents as like a regular marine type dude, but then you find out he has super strength, super everything. He enjoys the carnage. No personality, right? This is not a game about deep plots. They sometimes try to hit you with some lore and some, you know, some overviews of stuff. But mostly the thrill of these games is you go, you kill demons, you feel great doing so, you get better guns, you go kill some more bigger demons, and so on and so forth.
So he's like Master Chief if Master Chief was killing demons, essentially.
Sort of, but this guy's a lot more badass.
All right. Yes, okay. Agreed. And okay. I'm glad in the trailer they start off immediately with the super shotgun. And they give him a shield that looks cool. Now
the shield so it's like a chainsaw shield instead of a proper chainsaw because it is the Dark Ages, right? Because they don't have steam engines.
Yes.
So it's like a buzzsaw shield.
Yes, buzzsaw.
And he can throw it if anybody's played God of War. It's kind of a similar ride where they throw the shield, it messes up the enemies, and it comes back to him, right? Like a boomerang.
Mm-hmm. Now, the gameplay loop looks like it's going to be very engaging, even more intense, encouraging close quarters combat.
Right.
I was just blown away by just how gorgeous it looked. Like, graphics, like, it looks really good. That was in gameplay.
So you can tell these games are fully realizing the power of the PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X.
Series 1?
I don't know. Yes. The name is confusing on these Xbox consoles.
The latest Xbox.
The latest Xbox. This latest generation, a lot of the games have been, you know, basically old generation games that have just been ported over to the new generation. Right? A lot of them have even come out on both consoles. We're now fully starting to see games, you know, fully realized and designed for this latest generation, not worrying with the oldest generation at all. And you can tell. You can tell the upgrades. Oh, yeah. You can tell it looked better than ever. It's an exciting time if you're a video game fan. Usually we won't hit you with too much video game news here on It Was Mooney, but we wanted to give you guys a little bit of a twist here.
Oh, yeah. I definitely didn't mind just doing a kind of taking a detour in the trailer trash section, but no, this is awesome. Only thing, though, about that Doom game is it comes out, like, next year. So you have to kind of
It's supposed to come
wait.
Out next year, and it was just announced. It was
2025. You know, I'm okay with a year wait. That's pretty soon.
You're cool
to me.
Waiting? That That's was so cool. I wanted to play it, like, right now. So.
Video games are one of those things where I'd rather wait for the game to be good and to be polished.
Okay, that's fair.
You know, they don't have bugs in movies. They don't have, you know, lack of polished gameplay.
Crash or whatever.
Crashes. Okay. Yes. A lot of things you have to worry about in movies, and I'd rather them get it right. Oh, I have full faith in the team. Doom Eternal is one of my favorite games.
Oh, beautiful. You know what, generation. We'll be missing? Mick Gordon's music.
Ooh.
Yes. Heavy metal.
The heavy metal. We'll have a new one.
Hopefully the next guy.
Okay.
If you guys listen, if you like heavy metal, it really adds to the game. Well, if you know heavy metal music while you're mowing down these demons,
that kind of yeah.
You know, it's it gets the blood pumping, right? It gets the adrenaline charging through your veins.
It's like a glove, that kind of gameplay.
It's a thrill. It's a game that's it's full excess, no plot, full destruction, full joy. Heavily recommended.
There's only two words: rip and kill.
Hell yeah!
Three words, motherfucker.
All right, now it's good to go over that stuff. So, main topic of the day, guys, talking about Shogun.
Just off the bat, what did y'all think of this series as a whole? Like, folks are calling this like Game of Thrones level type, but on Hulu. Like, what did y'all think of the series?
You know, I could see that. Because
I love this.
It's funny. It's kind of a little bit of a digression, but it's funny always hearing like, "Oh, this is kind of the new Game of Thrones," when Game of Thrones itself has such a bad reputation now. Mm-hmm, you know, the first six seasons were so good. It's still everybody's chasing that next Game of Thrones because that was legit the last peak television show, the last show everybody watched.
Yeah, and you make a good point. It didn't end well, but make no mistake about it. Game of Thrones is, people try to get that because it set the standard and the tone.
It's such a cultural phenomenon.
The impact was there.
Yeah,
and you can't ignore it.
Yeah, and folks try to chase that, and I think Shogun is one of those shows that, like, it really, obviously House of the Dragon was obviously, like, came and did that, but Shogun the very next year was like, wow, like, what's possible on TV is, I was just blown away by this. So I loved it just off.
So I'm going to give a little bit of an overview here and talk about the different sections, kind of what we want to discuss. So Shogun is based on a book by Jim. What's the author's name?
James Clavell.
He wrote a book. He was actually, according to Jim, a prisoner of war for Japan in World War II.
Yes.
Right. So he had some firsthand experience. Obviously, the historical period the book is covering, the show is covering, is before World War II, well before World War II.
Right, it was in the 1600s.
Like fuel. Yeah,
right,
fuel
you know, several hundred years before, when Europeans were first making contact with Japan.
Clavell had first-hand experience with Japanese, and I think that's what part of the reason that inspired him to write this book.
Right. So he wrote this book. They made another series about it in 1980, after the book released in 1975. Kosi will give us a little bit of insight on that original series, the original miniseries. And then, of course, we're mostly reviewing and focusing on the series that came out this year with Hiroyuki Sanada, Cosmo Jarvis, Anna Sawai, some of the big names headlining this new series on FX, made by FX on Hulu. Nice to see, actually, FX making some good new series. They'd kind of fallen off a bit since the Disney merger, had some of the wins, some of their budget taken out for other products. But it's still very nice to see that after Atlanta, after The Americans, after some of these other hit shows they've made, they still got it. That's something, they made the What We Do in the Shadows 2 as well, right?
What We Do in the Shadows is also another FX show.
Yeah. No, they've made some quality stuff. So it's good to see them continuing that tradition.
Yes, and putting out the budget for it and keeping it compact to a nice miniseries at 10 episodes, 1 hour each. And it runs the full length of the book. You know, I wasn't sure when they said it was going to be about basically 10 hours worth of media that if it could cover this book, which is my all-time favorite book. But it's also a 1,000-page book. It's a very thick book. And I thought to myself, wow, are they just going to skim over certain things? And for the most part, I think they've captured the spirit of the book very well. And they've adhered to most of the critical parts. There's obviously always going to be differences. You know, the television media is different. And you always got to present it in a way that's engaging and mysterious and a little cliffhanging. But I think overall, the show did a really good job of paying homage to Clavell's book.
So take us through your experience reading this book. You say it's your favorite book. Mm-hmm. You say you love it. Take us through the experience reading it and then the experience watching it, some of the differences, some of your favorite moments, maybe from the book that were missing from the series or key Absolutely. Differences.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. So I read this book in high school. And I read it twice in high school. I even shared it with another friend of ours, if you remember his name, Anant Lal.
Yes,
he enjoyed the book as well.
Probably does not enjoy us calling out his full name, but okay.
And then most recently, I re-listened to the audiobook knowing that this was coming out. And the audiobook was wonderful as well. Hearing it now as an adult allowed me to recapture some of the moments even better. But there was always obviously differences, but at the same time, there's scenes I anticipated. And especially, I'll first mention the very first scene that I knew that from that moment that they were going to pay homage to the book. And it happens in the first episode when all the crewmates are put into a hole in the ground. And that obviously happens in the book. They're captured, they're put there. And I'm waiting for the moment that they're treated poorly and fish gets dumped on top of them. And it happens. Mm. And it's such a small nuanced thing, but like, oh my God. Yes, that happens in the book, and they repeated it in the first episode. In that moment, I knew, okay, they're going to keep doing certain things to it. And they kept also the very gruesome scene that everybody knows from the first episode. And let's touch briefly on it. The guy getting boiled alive.
Oh, yeah. That was horrible.
Oh, we'll touch as much as we want, man.
It was just his screams.
Full spoilers in this
episode. It's the screams for me. That was like, oh no.
Yes. For me, it was the end of it when, you know, his body was all melted up and stuff. And he smashed his head into the rock. To end it.
Apparently, that's some real stuff. They had to like stop them from like doing it. They had to kind of like string them up so they wouldn't knock their head. I don't know how true that is.
So the whole reason is, and they don't go into it too deep, but the reason is Yabu wants to discover how sturdy barbarians are and how much pain they can endure because he's a sadist. And they don't really capture that too much. They try to go into how much he's a sadist and how much he's a deviant. Okay. And, you know, he's kind of a weird and kind of odd. And he even at the end, he wants his own death to be kind of weird. He's mystified by death.
They go into it a little bit that he... Well, I can't remember what the exact line from the show is, but that he's fascinated by the moment of death.
Exactly.
Paraphrasing.
And that's why they boil...
And he has these kind of like little rankings.
Yes.
Exactly. These little rankings of like... I guess gruesome or interesting ways to die. Mm-hmm. I think he sees it as interesting. He sees it as a curiosity.
Right. I think the way he wished he was asking for his final moment is like, let me go get eaten by dogs, please. Oh,
yes, wow. He was begging to be or like eaten by fish or
something. Yeah, odd,
or eels or something. You know, he wants his gory death. Mm-hmm. It's portrayed as this like curiosity in the morbid.
I like how like even from the miniseries, I guess in the novel, but even to this one, the way they portray carnage, violence, it's done tastefully. I'm guessing reading it, it's written, described tastefully, but watching it, especially in the 1980s miniseries, it was the 80s, so stuff was a lot rougher, and like it was kind of easy to make it look rough and tumble, and like it really highlighted how tough it was. But I really appreciated it. But for this one, how when people are beheaded, when people are hurt and messed up, it's brutal, it hurts, but it's not gratuitous. It's not to say, hey, look at us, look how much blood we can show. It's like, no, when people die, it's effective, and there's a reason behind it, and I just love that about
this whole thing. Yeah, it's gritty for good reason, and it builds into the atmosphere, builds into this foreign environment as well that you're trying to thrust it into. And I think part of, you know, honestly, looking back on it, somebody would say that Shogun is a little whitewashed because it's written through Clavell, and you have this white guy that's kind of the hero of the story.
Blackthorn.
Yeah, Blackthorn, John Blackthorn. He's
the protagonist.
The protagonist, but he's kind of portrayed in this great way. And Shogun itself is a historical fiction, so every character in there has a real-life counterpart. So it was neat to see.
Including the British John Blackthorne?
Including the Blackthorne, who was in the real-life Torinaga, who was Tokugawa Ieyasu's court. He was there. He was actually risen up to, I think, maybe samurai level or close to it, but not maybe exactly what they gave him, but he was somebody that was risen up to that level.
So one thing I didn't realize coming into this, I thought Shogun was just, you know, another word for a samurai, but turns out Shogun is actually the leader of all of Japan. Yes. I believe all of Japan.
Like it is, the best way to describe it is total warlord. In order to become Shogun, and this is part of the nuance into it, you have to be of a certain noble family as well. So you can't be, anybody can become Shogun. You have to be part of the samurai class, and you have to be part of one of the families of the samurai class that can ascend to that title, which plays into the title itself of why Torinaga wants to chase after it. And Ishida is a peasant, and he is not able to ascend to that.
So, well, let's go into a little bit of the plot. Some of these names are easy to get lost in. So, a little overview of the plot. So, the show starts, and from what Jim's telling us, the book kind of starts and follows most of the same plot lines?
For the most part. I would say, from reading here, episode seven or eight is where it kind of diverges. Okay, and changes a little bit, but it comes back to the same.
We'll get into some of these differences because I'm curious about this. Mm-hmm. But we'll give a little bit of a plot overview of the show for some of the viewers who might not be fully familiar. So basically, the show starts off with Cosmo Jarvis as John Blackthorne, mostly called the Anjin in the show.
Meaning barbarian? Pilot? Yes,
pilot. Okay, pilot. Okay. That's what that meant. I thought it meant barbarian. So he's on a vessel. He's coming from England with a crew, and this is back before Europe has truly discovered the Japans, the East Asia.
And like any word out of it about it being there is like, they'll kill you, like, because they do not want that getting out.
He sailed from the Netherlands down to South America, crossing the Strait of Magellan, and coming up. He had raided along South America, and then as they were running away from pirates, they go to
France. So it's not just pirates, and what they were actually attacking the Portuguese and the Spaniards. I think particularly the Portuguese in this case.
Yes.
Because the British were Protestants, the Spanish and Portuguese were Catholics. They were the main Catholic, I think France was too, but powers at the time were Spain and Portugal. And they had mostly divided up the New World. Obviously, Christopher Columbus was the main first guy, so they had the first crack at it.
This is taking place in 1600.
Right. So he goes around South America, and he takes this crew, and he managed to be the first Englishman and takes those people to the Japans. At this point, the crew is basically decimated. Most of the ships have been lost. Almost everyone is dead. The captain general suicides himself at the beginning of the show.
Oh, man, that whole thing was crazy.
Right. They basically, it's about 5-10 people on a ghost ship that finally come upon Japanese islands. Now, one nice thing about having him be this random British white guy showing up in Japan and centering the story on him, even though he doesn't actually affect most of the full plot. The nice thing is it gives us that introduction as the viewer to 1600s Japan, right? That most of us aren't going to be familiar with off the bat. Most of us aren't going to understand.
So he has
to be exposed to it. And in his learning and in his exposure to it, it gives us the opportunity to be exposed to that culture as well. So that is one of the benefits to not centering the story around the Japanese.
Yeah, it's a relatable point of view, right? You know, it's a foreign guy in a foreign country that doesn't know the language. And I'll point out they do an excellent job of being bilingual throughout the entire show. Japanese and using English as a substitute.
Can I call out a little bit, which I laughed, there's not really any Portuguese. So they're actually almost entirely speaking Portuguese every time they speak English. Mm-hmm. Almost never in the show is anybody actually speaking English technically. It's almost always Portuguese. It's just that they speak English whenever they're supposed to be speaking Portuguese.
Yes.
It's just a funny thing. Every once in a while they'll say, like, speaking Portuguese, like one random, like, hymn in a prayer or something. Mm-hmm. But the Portuguese guys all speak English. The people who have only ever spoken Portuguese, the Japanese people who only know how to translate the Portuguese, speak English. The guy who says immediately, oh, hey, I know how to speak Portuguese, John Blackthorne. And he's an Englishman, which is why it's confusing, because he's speaking English with an English accent, and then he says, oh, yeah, this is Portuguese. So it is a little confusing.
Yes. Yeah. They did do that kind of odd. And even at the beginning, he's supposed to be speaking Dutch with his crew.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There's a Dutch crew. Mm-hmm. It's an odd effect. He's actually the only Englishman, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
The whole thing. Maybe he had one other person in the crew, or a few other people in the crew were Englishmen, but it's kind of a strange thing. Mm-hmm. It does take a little bit to get used to.
Yeah, it was kind of an odd kind of, oh, the subtitle will be speaking Portuguese, but you obviously hear English, and it was kind of a weird juxtaposition.
Right. Yeah, for some reason, I guess it tricked me to thinking it was Portuguese, but yeah, I guess not.
Yeah, no, it was a little confusing. Mm-hmm. Anyways, at this point, he comes in, he's on Japan, and, you know, that's when some of these scenes we talked about start. Mm-hmm. Basically, his crew gets captured, his boat gets taken from him. He acts like a haughty Englishman, demanding, you know, an audience with the people in charge, acting like an important guy. All the Japanese guys, they literally piss on him. The fish scene Jim is talking about, when they throw fish on him. We're talking about rotted, crappy fish with blood and stuff, where it's going to stink.
Good old fish guts.
Where it's going to stink and smell awful. And it's a form of torture, basically a form of putting these people in their place for not playing along and doing what they're told.
I'm glad they showed that, because as crazy as that is, like, that seemed like some stuff that would happen back then, and like, I was able to just gather, again, a lot of these shows do a lot of like telling, not, and like showing, and vice versa, but this one, it was very super effective with how like they're showing, like, here's how, because again, back then, and Jib, you gotta realize, like, they were not accepting of outsiders, period.
Oh,
like, they made sure their culture was protected, and like, they, if you're an outsider, no. So like, they wanted to convey that to the viewer. I think they did a fantastic job.
I mean, just
job
in general,
that.
Some strange people show up on your shores. The fact that these people expected to be treated as honored guests instead of, you know, pirates or suspicious characters. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think it's a little too naive.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So that's when we're introduced to Yabu Shige and his nephew.
Yes, Camera Blue.
Omi is kind of the main samurai in charge of the little village they come upon. Mm-hmm. And Yabushige is the lord in charge of that whole
province.
So he's kind of the boss, the lord. Everybody has to pay attention to him. And then he has a bigger lord. Mm-hmm. Hiroyuki Sanada's character, Yoshitora Naga.
Correct.
So at that point, again, we're still getting introduced. We find out that the Portuguese are already in there. There's actually a good chunk of Catholic. Even among the Japanese people, there's people who are fully Catholic at this point. Mm-hmm. Portuguese have a clear foothold in this land. They've made allies.
Yes.
They've even turned some of the major lords, the regents, the five regions that are kind of in charge and have the council in charge of Japan.
Yeah, it was really,
some of them were Catholic.
It was a really cool way of showing like how the Portuguese really have established the real foothold and stronghold, like in that, in a culture that, like, you know, kind of prides itself on keeping outsiders out. But again, it's showing, hey man, that the whole thing about colonization, like, it gets to where it needs to get to. Really,
you know, it has a similar concept, similar theme happened in the show we talked about recently, A Blue-Eyed Samurai.
Yep.
We talked about it a little bit. Actually, we didn't talk about it that much, but we probably should have. But, you know, the Japanese prided themselves on being, you know, isolated and independent.
Very homogeneous.
And having this, like, unique, special culture. But greed won out. Mm-hmm. You know, what ultimately did the Portuguese come and offer and got them the foothold? Trade and money.
Yes.
And a way for these people to feel rich.
But I would also argue that someone like Toranaga, as the Portuguese are using Toranaga was also using the Portuguese, people like Blackthorne, to get to where he needed to go too. So there was definitely some give on the A-10.
But as we know from a historical perspective, it didn't end up super great for Japan.
Well, of course not.
And for a lot of these countries. And again, the foothold was established and everything. Like, you know, they go into the trade that's happening. They kind of trail off a little bit with it, but John Blackthorne's kind of there to fight the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm. And he's the wild card there.
Yeah, he's telling.
He's the X factor.
He's telling them that the Portuguese, he's telling the Japanese that the Portuguese do not have their best interest at heart, mm-hmm. that the Portuguese do not see them as the people in power and people in charge.
Yes, and they're getting taken advantage of.
Right. The Japanese see themselves as, okay, we're the people. These people are coming to us. These people are helping us trade. We're the ones in charge here. They don't know that the Portuguese, you know, are backstabbing them, having secret fortresses, secret trade, taking, you know, selling them stuff that they can get for super cheap because they know other trading partners, and selling them to them for high prices. You know, basically taking advantage of the Japanese, or if they just by being a middleman.
Yes, and I think that was one of the fun scenes in like episode 2 was when John Blackthorne draws the world map on that sand in the ground and shows like, look, this is what the world really looks like. You're just this small island, and the world is divided up already. And
yeah, he's telling them, hey, that you know the Portuguese are claiming this. According to them, this, you know, you own Japan. Yes. They own Japan. They kind of drop that off a little bit. They don't go into that Catholic conflict and Protestant conflict as much towards the rest of the episode. Most of the rest of the episode focuses on the fact that, you know, there was a great leader, a Taiko, that came to power after the previous great leader was killed. Right? He was assassinated by his vassals for being too villainous, I guess.
He reminded me of almost like the Mad King a little bit. He was kind of like crazy.
Right. At least from the show didn't go into a ton of detail. Maybe the book, Jim, did the book maybe go into a little more detail?
Well, it was based off the three great unifiers of Japan, right? And I think the first unifier that everybody knows is Oda Nobunaga. And he was Gorida. And that was the guy that was assassinated. But really what happened was he was overcome by his vassals and he committed seppuku. And then that allowed the next guy, the Taiko, to rise up. And his name was Nakamura, and he was a peasant as well.
So this guy was a second unifier.
The second unifier.
And the Taiko was a peasant, which is very important to the...
to the ascendancy of the power.
Lore of the story.
Yeah, so a peasant could not achieve the status of shogun, but they could achieve a different, similar title, but it would not be shogun.
Okay.
And but the Taiko, I think it was Toyotomi Hideyoshi, is the real character. And eventually he would fall off. And that's where part of the story leads into, leaving his son behind and then leaving a council region.
So he dies. He dies an old man, and his son is still a little kid. Maybe at almost 10 years old.
Yes.
Oh, so that's why Torinaga then was like, hey, you can come in.
So the Taiko basically issued an edict that, okay, there's going to be 5 regions, 5 main lords, and there's going to be a council of them, and they're going to rule in the place of the Taiko's heir until he comes of age and can rule himself, right? And the whole movie, the whole book, I'm guessing, everybody honors that. For whatever else conflicts they have, everybody wants the Taiko's heir to be in charge. It's just they all have the awareness that a kid can't actually rule the country.
Exactly. And then how they maneuver is what they do.
Right, so everybody actually thinks things are doing what they're doing in the best interest of the Taiko's heir, right? Yeah, they're at least honoring him. They might have their own motivations, but nobody's trying to take him out or say he's unworthy or anything, right? That's an interesting point of it, where everybody's trying to gain power within the structure that's already circumscribed as basically the heir's favored regent.
And I think you kept saying that word power. That's a theme that brought up a lot in this whole series, both the book and mini series, all that. And I think the reason why I'm going back to Torinaga, Hiroki Sanada's Torinaga, is the way his angle for power was, he was always saying, I don't want it, I don't want it, I don't want it. His angle was almost like, kind of like false, like, but he was always 2, 3, 4, 5 steps ahead.
He was working for it.
He was working. He was really playing in the Game of Thrones, so to speak.
You know, I love that about the show. The way the show is framed, and obviously I hadn't read the book, but the way the show is framed, you know, Torinaga seems kind of like the wise ruler, the good guy, the guy who has, you know, he sees the bigger picture.
The benevolent ruler.
Yeah. You know, he's like kind of the Ned Stark. Right, it's going back, keeping on going with the Game of Thrones analogies, but like kind of the Ned Stark or the Aragorn of the series, where he's like this benevolent, smart, wise ruler.
Yes.
And the other guys are like the jealous, petty rulers. And then part of the great thing about the show is that you start seeing that, not that he's not wise and clever and stuff, But at the end of the day, he also just wants power. Mm-hmm. He's willing to abuse yep. people. All the honor and all the systems that are in place to like keep people in line. He's very happy to take advantage of those when it comes mm-hmm. to his yeah, benefit. Shamelessly. He's not one of those guys that, oh, yeah, we do this in Japan, but like when we progressive and like, oh, seppuku is bad and stuff. No, no, no. He's very much willing to have people suicide themselves for his cause.
The one guy that didn't want to either that didn't want to attack him, and he like what or
was the other way? Yeah,
so he got his head chopped off. That was a great usage of the rules of the rules, bro. It's
that
like,
was a that was that when was they awesome. Introduced seppuku, and I liked how they introduced awesome. It. I think the character's name was Usami, and he had interrupted Torunaga's conversation to Ishida, and as a result, he kills himself and his son to end their family line.
So a little context of that conversation, because we almost skipped over that. So the five regions, the main other region other than Torunaga is called Ishido. He's a peasant, kind of a bureaucrat that was served under the Taiko and became one of the favorite guys under the Taiko. I don't think they ever fully explain it, but he basically says, hey, Torunaga, you're a bad dude. You're not good for the Taiko's heir. You're not good for the realm. So we're going to impeach you, which means, like, impeach means you lose your spot on the council, and then you have to kill yourself. Like, we're going to order you to die, right? And then not just you die, like, your whole clan, like, it's most of your samurais, man. Your generals, like, most of your main guys loyal to you have to also kill themselves. Right, that's like we're just gonna order you to do that. Like we're just gonna vote for it, and then you have to literally kill yourself. That's it's a wild little it's like the, cultural,
yeah,
cultural that aspect.
That whole theme of loyalty, though, is like how it's tested, what it does to people, like how the lengths you'll go for it. It was really fascinating to see that back, like to have it play out and have it just affect the story.
Definitely it's see amazing. Characters multiple times. Actually eager for death because they failed in a mission or they didn't succeed and or they embarrassed themselves and they literally beg to be able to suicide themselves
and
for you know to avoid the shame.
And you know what, to bring this topic in, I think that this is when they introduced seppuku, but this is also one of the changes I'll talk about that they brought in. So the wife of the character has remained alive. She's Fujiko. And eventually she's given as, later on down the line, she's given as consort to John Blackthorne.
Yes.
And one of the changes that they made that I was, this doesn't come till the end, but it goes back to talk about seppuku. And eventually John Blackthorne and Fujiko, they get to get along together. John learns enough Japanese. They even lay together in the book. And they build a relationship. But you find out that Fujiko talks to Torunaga, and it is just all duty. In the end, it's all duty. Because Torunaga asked Fujiko, like, hey, so originally this period of time that I asked you to serve was 6 months. 6 months to serve John Blackthorne. Now it seems like you're enjoying it. Do you want to do it longer? She immediately says, no. No, I want 6 months, and I'm done. Let me commit seppuku immediately right after 6 months. Let me do it, please. And he's like, all right, that's fine. But what happens in the book is that she's allowed to go become a nun. What happens
in the show.
Yeah, in the show. Sorry, in the show. She goes to become a nun. In a book, what's supposed to happen is like, okay, Torunaga says yes. What you end up doing is you'll accidentally fall to your death during a journey that I send you on after the 6 months expires. And then I'll have something else prepared for Anjin's son. So it was just interesting to see that at the end of the show. And I know we're kind of jumping ahead, but I just want to talk about how at the end of the show, it feels like that was one part of ripping away stuff from Anjin-san. And another part was just trying to lay him bare. And then, well, actually, I'll take it back to you. But that was just one of the critical things I feel like they changed, which I felt like was kind of...
In episode 10, you mean Dream
yes,
of the
Yes, exactly.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. So basically that character, Fuji, she is the wife of the guy who kind of stands up for Torunaga. Because Ishido and the other regions kind of accuse him of being disloyal, accuse him of seeking power, accuse him of being a bad guy. And up to that point, I mean, he's been perfectly loyal, followed all the rules and stuff. They're clearly doing it out of a sense of insecurity and fear.
Yeah.
Right. He's they go over in the show a lot. The show doesn't entirely explain why this is important, but they call him a Minowara, I believe it's called.
That has to go with what I was talking about, the clans that can ascend into Shogun.
Right.
So that's a noble samurai family, a Minowara.
He has that kind of royal noble bloodline that means, you know, he has that extra level of authority, mm-hmm. potentially. But he was not in charge before. Before, an actual peasant was in charge. He didn't. Nobody in this line had been in charge for a while, mm-hmm. as far as I can tell. There hadn't been a shogun for at least a good chunk of time.
Yes.
Right? And he at least claims that he doesn't want to be a shogun, but that he does want to protect the heir. He tries to follow the rules. I mean, he comes to the capital knowing they're going to impeach him, and they're going to vote him out and probably ask him to kill himself. Doesn't mean he's given up, but, you know, he tries as much as possible to play within the rules, to play within the honor mm-hmm. system. He doesn't cheat the culture. He doesn't, again, he's not like some enlightened, mm-hmm. new age guy, progressive guy. He's full on trying to take advantage of the system from within.
Yes.
Playing by every rule of the system.
Which leads him to try to sneak out of the castle. And that right. was one of the prominent scenes. I think that was very funly done in the show, where they mm-hmm. kind of show that there's a switch. And even in the, I think the book, he's supposed to be wearing makeup. But
yeah, they kind of switch him for his wife.
Exactly.
They have these little, what do you call those? The little things they carry there.
Pelicans?
Yeah, pelicans, something like that.
Yeah.
Where they carry the litters they carry the royal women in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, his wife goes in, he's trying to leave the capital, he's clearly trapped, and they haven't managed to impeach him for several reasons. I honestly think it was that part of it was a little forced.
Yeah, I think part of it was like he stepped down from the council before they could impeach
him. That was part of it, but actually the reason they didn't impeach him immediately was because John Blackthorne came around.
Ah, yes.
And then basically he freaked out the Catholics, mm-hmm. the Catholic Portuguese, because, you know, he's a British guy and he was clearly trying to start a war and mess up the Portuguese people. And they were afraid of what they were going to tell, that he was going to tell the Japanese people and the technology and the knowledge he could potentially give the Japanese people. Mm-hmm. So they wanted him executed immediately, and they pressured the two Catholic regions to basically say, hey, John Blackthorne needs to die and needs to be captured right away. Mm-hmm. So that happened, but then...
I guess that paralyzed their vote is what it... They were saying that, like, hey, let's deal with this non-Portuguese Christian that Ishida suddenly appeared.
Wanted to immediately vote to execute Torunaga right away, but the other guys, again, they don't fully explain why they couldn't do both at the same time, frankly. Mm-hmm. But they said, no, wait... We got to deal with this John Blackthorne guy first. Forget the vote. Forget Torunaga. Until this guy gets taken care of, we can't keep going. Yes. I honestly, for my part, I thought that was one of the weaknesses, where it's not quite clear why they couldn't have impeached Torunaga and then dealt with John Blackthorne. Mm. Right?
Right. No, yeah.
I think it's because Blackthorne was under Torunaga, which was what led to like him getting kidnapped by the Greys. I think Ishida Gray controls the Grays and Torunaga the Browns, and Ishida was trying to remove this wild card factor, and then they could impeach him. But him just existing as a non-Portuguese Christian that was like could bring trade or other things was this just X factor, this wild card that they needed to remove.
Yeah, and then so the Christian guys basically refused to vote until he was removed, and they were pretty much had it. And then the real wild card of the whole show, Yabushige. We already talked about him a little bit, some of his torture tendencies.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
He's one of these guys. He realizes that Torunaga low-key basically suiciding himself by going to Osaka. He doesn't really understand what he's doing or think it's a good idea. So essentially, he kind of starts trying to play both sides, which is a big deal back then, right? Like, playing both sides, even now is bad, but back then it's okay, go immediately kill yourself once you're found out. Yes. Right? Like, immediately, no hesitation. Just go kill yourself right now. Like, not like being facetious. Like, mm-hmm. like I'll have a guy cut off your head for you and stuff. No, like, you're going to go do this right now. Mm-hmm. And so, anyways, he's kind of trying to play both sides. He's clever. First, can I say I love the actor. I love the performance.
Oh, Tatsunobu.
The little grunts he does. Like, the little kind of surprise faces he does. He does a great job of playing both sides, where you're actually legitimately curious what side he's on.
I just want to say, though, again, like you guys have just been highlighting this, from a Storytelling has been great, but just from the acting and performances standpoint, everybody on this show, top to bottom, is just incredible. It's just done an incredible job, and I think it just goes to show because, again, all I knew come up Shogun was like the miniseries, and like you know, it had like some premier actors. We had like guys like John Rhys Davies. He played Gimli in Lord of the Rings, so like he's like one of the more prominent actors in there. But coming from that one to Shogun 2024. I think just it's really hard to have this kind of come off as cheesy and maybe almost like, you know, doing too much. But I love how like just the performances, the set design, just the whole look. It was elegant, but also it was dirty. It was lived in. I just love that. And again, as a person that like didn't read the novels, this was like one of my first like main forays into it. Yeah, I just love what it was doing.
You know what? I do want to touch on that because you're right, Cozy. I mean, the acting was superb, top to bottom. Here, Yuki Tsunoda obviously is a legend.
Brilliant.
He does absolutely fantastic in everything
both
he
action
does.
And action, like both acting and action scenes.
Yeah, he does. Cosmo Jarvis. I actually haven't heard of him before this.
I've never seen him before.
A name like Cosmo? You think?
He's a noticeable name. He does a pretty good job. I love how well he plays this kind of aggrieved, haughty Englishman at the beginning. Very British, you know, absolutely believable when he's sitting there making demands of these people.
Savages?
Calling them savages.
Barbarians and savages.
Telling them that they have to go in front of the leader. These guys literally piss on him, throw fish on him, do all this stuff. Takes him a while to learn his place. Never really fully does. But towards the end, at least, he kind of realizes he can't be that much of a jackass.
And I think my favorite character in this whole series is Mariko.
Monarch.
Just saw in Monarch.
She was in Monarch.
This will be her greatest breakout role.
Loved her in this.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
A very nuanced role.
Yeah, it was very nuanced. A lot of going in there.
Honestly, my only critique of the plot with her is that it didn't feel entirely believable how quickly she jumped into bed with John Blackthorne.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Did it happen kind of the same way?
Yes, they did. And even part of it was like that first night where they buy John a prostitute, but she steps in.
Yeah.
That's when she kind of happens, and she kind of wants to experience a white man's embrace.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know. They kind of fall in love a little quickly in the show, and then there's, you know, immediately conflict starts. I mean, part of it is that she's in an abusive relationship with her husband.
Oh, she hates her husband.
Yeah, and then her husband seemingly dies. In fact, honestly, that was one of those. I don't understand how her husband survived, and frankly, how they never really went back. It was to the point where I actually thought her husband had become a spy and become a traitor.
Oh, no. Like that stuff doesn't really happen.
I thought he had made some kind of deal to become to come back.
No, in the book, it's glossed over as well.
Yeah, he's literally surrounded by like 10 people in a foreign city, zero chance of survival. Clearly, everybody sails away thinking he sacrificed himself for their benefit. And then somehow he just comes back and they just kind of gloss over it.
Yes. Gloss over in the book as well.
It was kind of bizarre, honestly.
And he has, he has one memorable scene and they kind of changed it a little bit in the show as well. And that's the scene where he gets drunk and goes to see Anjin-san or John Blackthorne. And it's just only slightly changed, but I feel like I wish they would have kept it because it just would have shown him how much more badass he really is. He drunkenly shoots arrows to a post. And in the show, he only does 2 arrows. In the book, he does 5 arrows that all go through the same hole. And John Blackthorne is like, this is amazing. I'm going to leave this here as a trophy.
I feel like 5 arrows would have been too... from a TV show perspective, it would have just been too much.
Maybe a little bit too
much. I mean, a little bit extra.
I mean, it was pretty badass as it was. The fact that he shot 2 through the same hole right with his wife's face right there.
Yes.
And both arrows hit the same spot. I mean, you clearly understand how much of a badass he is.
Yes.
That's another one of those things. I kind of appreciate the show does this, but it's okay. You show how badass this guy is, and then he just never fights again.
Yep, Kind of.
He never has a fight scene again.
You know, there's one thing that I was also missing, that which is his father, Hiramatsu, the old man, right?
Yes.
And I wish they would have kept it. He's so much more menacing in the book, and he's just walking around holding the scabbard of his sword, like as he's walking around everywhere he goes. Even if you're not allowed to have a sword, he's like, "Fuck you, I'm here with my sword." But I feel like one thing that they changed in the book. From the show, and we're coming up to as we're discussing it, as Torunaga escapes from the castle, gets on the galley, races away after the galley. Actually, on the galley, a bunch of things happen that like causes people to die, and John Blackthorne feels an immense amount of guilt for this. This is not expressed in the show at all, but one scene that I know that I was waiting for, that I was secretly hoping for that they could reproduce, was that John tries to commit seppuku. As a result of these people on the galley dying. He has this great sense of guilt and responsibility for the people on the galley that he had built a camaraderie with. And he enters into this like Zen moment where he tries to plunge a sword into his heart in front of Mariko and Omi and another person. And Omi places his hand in front of the blade and stops it. And as a result of him trying to commit seppuku, he earns the respect of these people there. And they elevate and respect him as, okay, a samurai. Mm. But that's not able to be conveyed in a show as well. And it's how do you elevate the respect for Anjin-san as a result if you don't have this?
Speaking on that, I thought it was kind of cool like when he was going to do that. In the show, he kind of started off with the show saying, hey, I'm never going to die in this stinking land. Mm-hmm. And to show, like, you know, how he was when he got there, to show this, the whole, I just love this arc. And now he's willing to die for their custom and, you know, right? die in that land.
I'm glad you brought that back.
It was really cool.
In episode 10, they give him that chance to commit seppuku. So they bring it back, and I think that adds a nice epilogue to feel it. If we call episode 9 the climax, the epilogue, they give him the opportunity to embrace that culture. And I think that was well done and was necessary for TV.
I guess, like, to wrap it up, I know the book, I know this much. There, Shogun, there's no part two in the book. Mm-hmm. I know there's a series, but there's no, like, part two of what we saw. There is. They've been greenlit for season two. Hiroyuki's not as coming back. What do you think? Because whatever's going to happen will be brand new stuff.
Okay, in so Shogun if 2. They go do that, so... James Clavell wrote other books as well. The only one I've read or heard, listened to, is Taipan, which takes place in Hong Kong. He wrote another one that takes place in Japan, which is Gaijin, but that takes place in 1863, which is far after. So if they continue with a sequel, it can only be one of two things. One, they make a fan fiction of Shogun, and they continue with the historical fiction of it. Or two, they kind of spin it their own completely brand new way. There's no original media to follow.
Because it looks like...
The book's complete.
Yeah, it looks like what's next is Torunaga just going to go and just continue his conquest.
The book is complete. I guess continuing on with some of the plot. I mean, basically the show ends and the show continues to where Mariko gets sacrificed. Torunaga gets seemingly out-tricked. His own brother gets added to the council. And they're all going to vote to execute him. The only reason he doesn't get executed is because his son rebels against the order. His son's a little hothead and tries to kill his uncle, the brother that betrayed Torunaga, and fails and kills himself by slipping and cracking his head on a rock.
And that's where it diverges from the book. That does not happen in the book.
So it gives Torunaga some grieving time. Basically, they have an official grieving period. And it gives him some time to try to make a comeback and make a play for it. Mm-hmm. And then he basically sacrifices Mariko. He sacrifices her in order to basically win over the Taiko's son's mother, the heir's mother. She hates Torunaga because she's actually the son of the original leader, before the Taiko. Mm-hmm. She's a daughter of the leader of the Taiko. And she blames Torunaga for being a party to the original leader's death.
Mm-hmm.
So she wants to kill Torunaga even more than Ishido does. Ishido just seems like he wants to kill him for power. just because he fears that of insecurity, like being a peasant, doesn't want this guy who's like a royal blood potentially being a threat. This lady, what's her name? Oshibo no...
Yeah, Oshiba.
Oshiba no something.
Yatsu...
She went on Yatsu. She like takes a different name, but like she's Taiko's son's mother, and she hates Sonaga. So they all basically things escalate when she gets there. They go from just kind of trying to casually politic against him to like legit. They take hostages, all the families of the regions,
kill people,
put them all in the castle, and basically threaten them. Hey, you either vote for this, or we kill you all.
Yes,
and. They wrap it up, and in history, Toranaga eventually wins, of course. Follows figures. Tokugawa Ieyasu, sets the Tokugawa shogunate, which rules Japan for 250 years.
Really?
Yes. Oh, okay. So and that's where, and so the book ends right before what's called the famous Battle of Sekigahara. And that's where, if you see the armies line up, and that's where they're right about to do that famous battle. And the book ends there, and the series ends there. So if there is a sequel,
I would presume it would focus on that. There's a couple of things they could focus on.
That's cool.
So the book ended with Anjin, with John Blackthorne. Mm-hmm. Again, being willing to kill himself at this point, his original mission has become meaningless. The Englishman, he found this crew at some point, and he basically doesn't care about them anymore. He doesn't connect or relate to them anymore.
You know, I was rewatching the 10th episode today, and something else they did weird is they kind of showed John Blackthorne as an old man and back home with his
kids.
That was weird because, one, the original actual like living human being never goes back, and then they kind of make a point that he doesn't ever go back. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm not sure why that was included there, maybe to give him sense of like closure for people.
That's what it felt like to me. That was bizarre to me, too,
especially because of the way the series ended, where I didn't know this, that it ended at the same spot as the book, right? But because the series itself clearly leaves on a cliffhanger, sets up a season two.
Yep.
You know, basically at the end, Marco has sacrificed himself to prove that Ishido is both corrupt and basically the lady, the Taiko's mother who wants Toranaga dead, she was a childhood friend with Mariko. So when she sees the lens Ishido's willing to go to kill her just to maintain control, she kind of flips on him.
Yep, turns a tide.
She kind of flips on him. Even though at that point she's betrothed to marry Ishido, right? She agrees to marry him to kind of keep that power and to protect her son. Honestly, her motivations are kind of weird because she's like dead set on killing Toranaga just because she hates him so much. And then somehow she ends up in a scenario where she betrays the guy that's clearly loyal to her in order to side with Toranaga. And I didn't quite understand that decision on her part.
Yeah, I don't think there's a clear-cut answer, but I guess...
To me, it felt like she was just grieved. So yeah. Like, that's how
I think she was grieving her friend and kind of lashing out, but...
Yeah, makes you just not make great decisions.
I mean, honestly, her life has been pretty tragic. She's a very tragic story where she's this daughter of this ruler, obviously. She doesn't see her father as the bad guy. But these other people do, including the dad of her childhood friend, who in the show kills her dad. Right. Can you imagine that? Your childhood best friend and her dad kills your dad.
Yes.
Suddenly, that friend has to leave because she's married off. And she's married off in part because the dad knows he's going to kill this guy so to protect his daughter. He marries her off so she can't be killed. And then this daughter has to run away from the capital and take on a new life. And then somehow ends up in a scenario where the wife of the new ruler after her dad says, hey... Come be the consort / hoe for my husband.
Yeah.
Come bear him a child. Yeah, that's an interesting theme of Japanese culture where like you know, you have like the main wife and then you have these consorts who are the ones bearing the children.
Yep.
Seemingly a lot of the times. But then it's all the child is still considered like part of the family, right? Mm-hmm. It's it's almost like polyamory kind of thing. It's interesting.
Surrogacy, you know?
Kind of a surrogacy
definitely
thing.
Surrogacy.
But they're kind of brought into the family.
Yes.
Right? Like the wife, the older wife of the Taiko is not jealous of the younger consort who gives her, who gives him a child. She actually kind of sees the child as an extension of her own family, right? She's not like bitter that she couldn't give him a child and that this younger lady is coming in and doing her job for her. She actually selects her. She's actually the one responsible for, you know, making this happen. It's a very interesting culture.
Yeah.
Honestly, one of the main takeaways here is that the culture that's revealed, very different from our own, very different from our individualized kind of freedom-based kind of individual liberties and individual rights versus collective duty, collective necessity. I love the show. I think it's the best show of the year so far.
Yeah,
absolutely. No. As a, you know, it being my favorite book, it did justice. It did. It hit every note that I wanted. It hit certain scenes that I was looking for, like a Fujiko with a gun scene that was perfect. They brought up the pheasants. That was the pheasant scene was about him hanging up a pheasant, and it got too smelly that somebody had to disobey him and take down the pheasant, and that person committed seppuku, and he that you know that hung on him as a guilt thing, and that was such an important scene, and they kept it as well. Right. And it was just so many things that they hit note after note, and they wrote it so well to condense it within 10 episodes of 1 hour. Right.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic adaptation, and you know, again, it's I consider it now the standard. Now I'm looking now for other shows to
what
do
about
with this.
The 1980 miniseries, because you know you've been mentioned a few times you watched. So how would you rate the two?
The reason why, like it, this the reason why I didn't really mention this a lot. I just wanted to just mention a couple things because the 2024 series just kind of. It improved on everything that the 80 series did. Okay. One thing that I will say back at just a couple of fun facts about the 80 series, it wasn't received all that well in Japan. Again, just because the depictions of these like fictionalized events, like, you know, these aren't real events, that there's actual history, Japanese history.
Yeah, it's historical fiction. They're kind of like, oh, you bastardized our history. Kind of thing,
yeah. Right? And so, but again, you know, but over here in America, it was like kind of groundbreaking because it was the first network. It was the first show that allowed like the use of the word piss because they showed that urination scene and they say, I piss on you in this country. Like that's where those uttered. They also were, it was very groundbreaking, the fact that just kind of the violence that they showed and the nudity they showed, kind of like pre-HBO, but like this was like back in the 80s. So again, it's one of those shows that like looking at it and then looking at the 2024 show, I can see where they improved. I can see what they definitely took from it. The crude, like they definitely in the 80s miniseries, what I give it credit for is showing It's a rough existence in feudal Japan. It's not fun. It's not, because that was back when a lot of like Kurosawa films had been Kurosawa films had been past their heyday. So now, like, you know, this is like on TV. It's like one of those first like TV movie miniseries, or how you want to call it. So like it definitely showed how rough it was. And then again, I said this again, John Rhys Davies. It's one of the first show, because my grandma would watch this show a lot, and like it was like on. She had like VHS tapes of it, and that's right, because as a kid I'd watch Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, so I saw Sala, and then see like a young Sala like 9 years prior to being in Last Crusade. It was really cool. So like again, the 2024 is the definitive. I'd say is the definitive on-screen version of Shogun. Yes, I say go back and watch. I say watch everything. Watch the miniseries, read the book, to just see how the progression went. And like the miniseries, I think, was a nice kind of like baton pass, because it showed kind of proof of concept of turning such a rich book series into like what's now made for TV. And now, 40 years later, we're getting what we see on Hulu. So yeah, I just love that. The miniseries paved the way. It wasn't the best. I wouldn't say it's the best, but I still think I think it's worth a watch. Just see where this series kind of had, see where it came from. Definitely read the books. The books are amazing from all accounts. But that's my piece on the miniseries.
No, good to hear, Cozy. No, absolutely. It's gotten a lot of hype. I think we're all three in agreement here. This show of the year.
Oh yeah,
I do absolutely have some criticisms. Where basically some of the show seems to assume you know either the history or you've read the book. A lot of the stuff, a lot of the backstory is almost glossed over. You're kind of
There's definitely some of that.
Yeah, you're kind of thrown into some of this stuff without really knowing the backstory, what's going on. Some of the plot threads don't really go anywhere, like the whole Catholic plot thread, Catholic versus Protestant, mm-hmm. ends up being kind of irrelevant to the main.
It is really tough to tie up every end there is, but I see that as like it's definitely criticism, but
it does
like,
give it a chance for it to show up more in season two.
Definitely. Yeah.
Give us a little chance to resolve a lot of this stuff. Or that's where I see where it could go. It could have more of that, you know, British versus Portuguese conflict. It could show actually Toronaga finishing getting power and seeing the process. You know, it's there's some places for it to go. I want to see more.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I want to see more. I've been spoiled. I think it's exciting. Obviously, I didn't realize the book ended exactly where the series ended, and that there's no more book necessarily to follow. So that does scare me a little bit as far as where they could go and making sure they go somewhere that's just as good as where we went in the first book. Mm-hmm. But you know, I like selfishly, I want to see more of these characters and where they're going.
I think it'll be interesting to see if some sort of fan fiction or some sort of sequel could be created with these characters. And the writing was done in such a unique way to media for television that I feel like it can continue and it can be something good, and we don't have to worry about like, oh, it has to pay homage to the source material. Now that we're past that, we'll be allowed a little more creative freedom, especially if we continue the line of historical drama and historical fiction, and then we'll be able to create something new, and it won't be something that has to be coming from a book.
Hopefully. I'm optimistic. The creators, Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks, did a fantastic show with the show. All the actors.
So good.
Looking forward to see what they do with season two. So I think that's it for our Shogun review today. Before we end the show and we get into the plug of the week, we wanted to go back to our one shot.
One shot. One opportunity.
We spun the wheel. We reviewed the first show. We're going to have it on a two-week rotation. Every other week, we'll spin the wheel, pick a next show, review the show on the next week's episode.
We're doing this for you guys. It's all for you.
Give ourselves a week break to be able to really review and come up with the show properly. Anyways, without much further ado, Cozy, I think it's time for spinning the wheel, right?
All
right,
Maurice. Let's do this.
All right. Let's see what lands, guys.
Good roll, Maurice.
As the first time we're spinning first for streaming service, and it looks like we've come upon Crunchyroll/HIDIVE.
All right. Anime. Oh, with me here? All right. Show, I mean.
Jim. It's meant to be. Maurice made sure to spin it properly for Jim, right? Might be able to get a good recommendation off you, Jim. And then we are spinning a drama/thriller.
Okay.
Drama/thriller.
Okay. Jim, you got any good good animes here on Crunchyroll we might be able to watch as a drama? Anything
you
would
recommend?
Drama, you
know what? Okay. You can watch. This is kind of a weird one to recommend.
Preferably something recent, something that's kind of new.
So, no, this is actually, the third season is airing right now.
Should we also look at HIDIVE as well since it's listed? Let's just do Crunchyroll. Okay.
Yeah. I think this one's fine.
Okay.
But it's a little different from drama. It's high school drama.
Okay.
And
up there. Oh.
This one would be called Sound Euphonium or Hibiki Euphonium. And it is about drama that takes place within a high school concert band. Oh, there it is right there, actually. That's the third season.
Sound Euphonium?
Yeah, Sound Euphonium. A euphonium is a band instrument. But I would recommend watching the first episode and just seeing how it feels. There's excellent music, especially if you enjoy symphonic music. And you know what? It's high school drama. It's kids getting through certain tensions of coming into an adulthood. And the fun part about this particular series is that this third season is them being in the third year. So the first season is them being in the first year. And you watch them progress with each season as they go through the 3 years of high school in Japan.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, yeah, I guess that's going to be our show. Let's check it out. It's called Sound! Euphonium.
You heard it here, guys.
It's a strange word. I don't think I've ever heard that word.
Yeah. Euphonium is an instrument. It's the instrument that the main character plays. It's like a smaller tuba is what I would call it.
Okay. Interesting. So that's what we're going to review on here next week, Sound Euphonium. Make sure to come back so we can catch it live.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim. Thank you.
All right.
All right. As we end the show, it's time for the plug of the week. Jim, as always, guest first.
Oh, thank you. You know what? I got a twofold plug because we're talking about Shogun. And first, I'll just go ahead and plug the book, right? And if you're not a reader, I recommend the audiobook. The audiobook is great. I think it's 42 hours, so it's quite long. But it is a fantastic book by James Clavell, and it lives up to it. If you enjoyed this TV series, you'll definitely enjoy the book. Now, if you're not a reader and you're a gamer instead, then I'll recommend Shogun Total War, the video game. And that is an excellent strategy war game. If you enjoy the other Total War series, such as Rome or Medieval or even the Warhammer games, if you like live combat, if you like strategy games, Shogun Total War. And that's the first game they made. So Shogun 2 is technically the one that's the latest. So again, either read Shogun the book or listen to the audiobook, or Shogun Total War the video game is my plug of the week.
No, good. It's a good plug, Jim.
All right.
All right. Cozy, what about you?
My plug of the week is going to be Paper Mario Thousand Year Door Remake on Switch.
Well, we already plugged it, but I'll
allow it. Did we already plug it?
I did, but I'll allow it because it's such a good game.
All right. Oh, yeah. Paper Mario.
I'll plug it again. That's because I recently kind of replayed the original Thousand Year Door. So I guess I'll play the original because the original is so great. It's a game that I always wanted to play as a kid. I think I borrowed it from a friend, but never got to finish it. Recently I got it. My girlfriend finished playing it. She loved it. So now I'm trying to get on it and play. And yeah, it's great. And then seeing the remake on there, I just got me excited to get that for on Switch. So yeah, that'll be my plug of the weekend. Yeah,
I'm playing really the excited. Original Paper Mario with my wife in anticipation. It's Paper Mario series is absolutely fantastic. So I highly recommend it. So for my plug of the week, I'm gonna take it to the bizarro side. I'm gonna plug Smiling Friends. It's an Adult Swim show. Honestly, that probably tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, that's it. Adult Swim.
Say no more. How bizarre is it?
No, if you all remember the days of Aqua Teen Hunger Force and Squirrelbillies and all these other oddball, weirdo shows, late night. You know, Rick and Morty kind of made it a little more sanitized, a little more mainstream, so to speak. But true Adult Swim is having, you know, cheaply animated characters and absolutely bizarre, wild scenarios.
Yeah, it kind of freaks you out a little bit.
So, Smiling Friends is basically the concept. It's a charity that helps people smile. And the whole point is that they pretty much do anything to make anyone smile if they ask them for help. Scenarios like, for instance, some guy comes in and says he needs to be made to smile. And he's like this big kind of steroids bully, so he literally like cuts off the main guy's nose, beats the shit out of him, breaks walls, just like tortures this dude until he eventually smiles because somebody else just dies accidentally.
He got him to smile.
Yeah, you know, just like, and then he goes home and is sad and beats himself up because he pushed away somebody he cared about. It's like this kind of bizarro weirdo stuff, right? Like they try to like help the president of the United States smile, except the president, like, it's like a weird animated show with like hand-drawn 2D characters, and then the president is a real actor, and it's just like the slob with chicken wing sauce all over him, and he's throwing up because he ate some bad lamb, and then somehow the president of the United States because of an accident. It's like, it's all kinds of weird bullshit. I don't even know if I like even enjoy the show, but it's the kind of show I can't stop watching. Recommend checking it out. Again, you'll probably regret it and ask me what the hell's wrong with me and not enjoy it. But
what the hell's wrong with you? Ask it right now.
Yeah, but you know what? Check it out because if nothing else, it's unique. It's
what is that one more time?
Smiling Friends on Adult Swim.
And where can people watch it on?
Adult Swim. Well, I guess Max. Okay. It's on Max. There's an Adult Swim app, I think, as well, but you can watch it next day on Max.
All right. Thanks.
It's coming out. Season 2 is out right now. It's airing every Sunday.
Sounds good. I'll take a peek at it.
Sounds good. Yeah. All right. Dude, Jim.
Yes.
Jimothy. Great episode.
Absolutely great episode. Yeah, love having you on board as always.
No, thank you. Glad to be here. Looking for the next time I can join y'all.
No, seriously, you're open invitation. Come back, man. Seriously, anytime. I loved having you on. Loved hearing you just talk. Just hell yeah. So well, thank you, Jim, once again. Thank you, Wani B. And thank you guys, listeners, again, for tuning in. Again, please like and subscribe to us on Spotify. Also, please like and subscribe to us on our YouTube channel, where you can get access to our episodes and other content. And again, I want to thank you all. And until next time, guys, peace.
Adios.
Peace out.